very well, yes,
very well
from
measurable.
Very,
very little to say. Very little to say in addition to what I said in the chapel. We're not here basically for the sake of T.S. Eliot. We're here basically for the sake of our Lord Jesus Christ. But T.S. Eliot could definitely help if we make intelligent use of him towards our Lord Jesus Christ and towards getting to heaven. That's what we're here for. It's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. White, who's a top class lecturer and severely underemployed at this point in time. But these things are in the hands of God. So welcome, Doctor. We'll listen attentively. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me back, and it's always a good sign when you're invited back anywhere. It means whatever you did the first time wasn't outrageous enough to keep you from a return. But I have to start by saying I already have this sense that I may begin with a little venial sin, because many of you have brought beverages with you, so I'm feeling envy. But I encourage you all to enjoy yourselves. It will give you something to occupy your time while I babble on up here, but in any case. Very good to come across the herring pond to speak about Mr. Eliot, who was also an American who came across the herring pond. And transferred his allegiance from his native land of the U.S., one of the greatest poets we have ever been fortunate enough to produce, but he wound up an English citizen for a number of reasons. I'll touch on that later. But let me begin with this. You're going to have a lot of poetry read at you, but it's inevitable because I'm talking about a poet. And in order to really appreciate, understand, have any grasp of poetry, you must hear it read aloud. Poetry is for the ear, not for the eye. And as a result, if you should in the future read any Eliot at all, try to read it aloud, and try to read it aloud more than once. So let me begin with a little-known poem by Mr. Eliot, and we can say this way that this series of lectures begins with a warning, okay? A warning label to you from the man himself. This little poem is called Lines for Couscous Caraway and Mirza Murad Ali Beg. How unpleasant to meet Mr. Eliot, with his features of clerical cut, and his brow so grim and his mouth so prim, and his conversation so nicely restricted to what precisely, and if, and perhaps, and but. How unpleasant to meet Mr. Eliot, with a bobtail cur in a coat of fur, and a porpentine cat, and a wopsicle hat. How unpleasant to meet Mr. Eliot, whether his mouth be open or shut. So that comes from the man himself. And one reason I wanted to start with that is to make clear that the usual vision of Mr. Eliot, one of the finest minds, one of the most complex poets, one of the most difficult poets of the 20th century, and acknowledged as being a word master, could take himself quite lightly. And there is another side to him, and the question that will be pursued through all of these talks is a simple question that haunted him his whole life, and that is, who was Mr. Eliot, and what has he left behind him? So that's what we will be, we'll be looking at. Who is he? Now, usually when you talk about who is a human being, you begin with the biography. Now, I'm going to give you some biographical information. It's very important. But I'm not going to spend that much time going through his entire life. I'll give you the high points that are very important in terms of his thinking, his career, his development, what he went through, what developed him as a person. But I'm not going to do a thorough biography. The best books for reading about Eliot, first and foremost, a very decent biography by a British biographer named Peter Ackroyd. So if you want the entire Eliot story told, it's well worth reading Mr. Ackroyd's biography. There is a new book that just came out this spring by an American named Robert Crawford that's called Young Eliot. It's the first half of a two-part biography that Crawford is writing. It is superbly well done. It stops with the publication of The Wasteland. Part two will not appear until sometime after 2020, for the very good reason that there are very important letters written by Eliot to a woman in New England that had been sealed until 2020. And that relationship was so important, and the material in those letters of such great necessity to any biographer, that Crawford has already said he's sitting on whatever work he does until those letters are released at that time. And then he will finish part two of the biography. So one could speculate what's in them, but it's hardly fair to do so. Eliot was an American. Born on September 26th, 1888, in St. Louis, Missouri, St. Louis. He came from a fairly prominent family. The Eliots were well known. The Eliots were originally British. And the first Eliot to come from England to America was a great-great-great-grandfather named Andrew Eliot, who left East Coker and came to Beverly in Somerset and traveled by boat to Beverly, Massachusetts, where he settled. The family then, over time, moved from New England to St. Louis, and Eliot's grandfather, Charles Ware Eliot, a very prominent, William Greenleaf Eliot, the Charles Eliot became a prominent figure at Harvard later, but Eliot's grandfather, William, became very well known as a prominent Unitarian minister in St. Louis and was one of the founders of Washington University, a major university that still is in St. Louis. At the time of its founding, it was the pillar of Unitarianism in the United States. This, I think, may be the most significant fact about Eliot's background, because he came from a family that was originally Puritan, and that Puritan background influenced the family for generations, but then moved away from Puritanism to Unitarianism. Now, just a few words about that. I don't believe it's as prominent as it once was, but it was a step on the road to the complete dissolution of any faith whatsoever. The Unitarians were founded in the 17th century in Poland and Transylvania, but it didn't become a large movement until it transferred to England, and in the 18th century, Unitarianism took hold in London, and it became a prominent intellectual community in London. And the Unitarians were defined by exactly what the name says. They denied the Holy Trinity. They believed in a God, but there was one God. And they were, if you will, a religious kissing cousin to the deists, who said, well, there's a God who created the universe and set things in motion, but then pretty much let it run. They would honor our Lord, but simply say that Jesus Christ was the best man who ever lived, who fulfilled the principles of morality and decency and kindness and charity that we should all live by, but he was not divine. And the sacrifice did not have any particular meaning other than his willingness to die for those he loved. They denied the third person of the Trinity pretty much completely, the Holy Spirit. And the most important aspect of this curious belief system is they denied original sin altogether. So that one was expected to be moral and upright, but one would be moral and upright simply because that's what a decent person did. So there was morality in the family, high moral standards, but for their own sake. You are good because that's what human beings are supposed to do, and if you want to measure up to being a genuinely good human being, then that's how you behave. That's the commitment you make. This is what Eliot was raised in, okay? And his father and mother, good, decent people, no doubt about it, he came from a real family, were staunch Unitarians because that's what had been passed down to them. His mother was named Charlotte, known as Lottie to all her friends. She was a lady of culture. She herself wrote poetry. She liked music. She was a good mother to her children. His father, nicknamed Hal, was a serious businessman, hardworking, a good father, who loved music, who took care of his children, and had great success in business in St. Louis, in brickworks. He became the manager of a manufacturing outfit that made bricks and other building materials. Very successful. So they handed something to their son. There was something good. The family life, the importance of family, the notion of working hard, the importance of art, music, certainly poetry from his mother. He was surrounded by it. But here's Eliot's own statement from his later years about the Unitarianism that he was brought up in. There was a fondness for the church buildings that he carried with him from childhood. The architecture impressed him. But nevertheless, the ideas were something that he had to come to terms with, and he said that he had been brought up in, quote, a strong atmosphere of the most liberal theology, and concluded in his adulthood that Unitarianism is a bad preparation for brass tacks, like birth, copulation, death, hell, heaven, and insanity. All those higher things. But it was a polite way of saying he was not given any background, any training, any information about the things that he would hit, the troubles that human beings run into, the genuine spiritual concerns were not part of his upbringing. Morality, yes. But please notice that all of it limited to the secular order. The rest of it was simply not there. I'll tell you a little story. This is absolutely true. I was raised very liberal Protestant. Most of you probably know that. Congregationalist at the time. As soon as I got to the university, that was all knocked out of me instantly because I learned it was not intellectual. There was nothing to it. It was all a myth. It was all phony. And, of course, being a young man filled with ego and pride, if I wanted to be part of that intellectual community, then I had to dump the few things that I'd been given, even in liberal Protestantism. My last year at university, my senior year, I was getting ready to graduate. I did theater. I've always done theater. But I was doing the production of Shaw's Major Barber that was opening a new building for the oldest community theater in Minneapolis. And there was a lady who worked there, who was a part of the production, who was just delightful, lovely woman. And I got to know her and her husband, who was a Unitarian minister. And I went one night to a dinner that they were having at their home. And it was a lovely dinner, and all the people were very, very nice. And in the midst of the dinner, the phone rang, and her husband, the minister, went to the phone and was talking on the phone, and I happened to be situated near the kitchen where the phone was and heard him on the phone arranging an abortion for a young woman in his parish. And the Unitarian thing died in me instantly. I somehow was so repulsed that I was grateful for the dinner, I was grateful for her friendship, but deep inside of me, there was a revulsion at what I had heard. And I think at that point began to realize I was completely unprepared for what the modern world would hand me, and that was true for Eliot as well. I think it's one reason for his extreme reaction to the modern world. It wasn't extreme, but he was hit with something that was so far beyond what he could conceive of, what he had learned, what he had been taught, that it was such a shock to him that he had to recognize what was happening out there and explore it and explain it to himself and then set down what he saw happening. But, and this is extremely important, it was a pilgrimage from a starting point that was so far away from what those of us as traditional Catholics understand. It is one thing to have some Christian upbringing, to have even some basics that give you a hint of supernature, and then come over to the fullness of faith. But to begin where he did was an incredibly long journey. So I'm going to chronicle that journey as we go along. Now, he was the sixth child in a family of six. He had four older sisters, and then an older brother. And then there was another daughter who was born deformed, who died soon after she was born. Eliot then came as the last child in the family, but he was aware that his parents had just lost a child before he was born, and indeed he wasn't a healthy baby. He was born with a double hernia that he carried with him for his entire life. From the time he was a boy, he had to wear a truss, and that truss was with him for the rest of his days. It made him, I think, hypersensitive. It's very understandable why. Very shy. He also had very large ears. He was pale. Because of the sickness, he was extremely thin. He was withdrawn. He had terrible teeth that caused him great agony for most of his life. As a result, and this is not unusual in such cases, he began to live a very private, personal life early on. He wasn't social, and for almost all the rest of his life, he could be social, he learned to be polite, but he was never gregarious. His refuge, very like the young Dickens, who was being shuttled about from pillar to post, his refuge became literature. And he became a great reader and a lover of books. Read at length, and the list is understandable. Dickens, Lamb's Tales from Shakespeare, Hawthorne, the Greek myths. I mean, all of those things. He had a particular love for the Arthurian legends, and said to the end of his days that the book he treasured most was Malory's Mort d'Arthur, that was filled with all the Arthur stories. And I'll come back to that when we get to the Wasteland. It plays a very important part in the Wasteland. So that literature was always there. He had a profound love for Lewis Carroll and also Edward Lear. He loved nonsense poetry. And I'll give you an example in just a moment of the first poem he wrote that we still have. And the influence, I think, will be unmistakable. So as he was discovering influence, there was literature, there was one other influence on him that was extremely important. As a young boy, he had a nursemaid. She was a nanny who helped take care of him because his mother was busy doing good works. Okay? And it was not unusual to have a nanny in the home, given their social position. Her name was Annie Dunn from County Cork, Ireland. And when he was six, she would take him to Mass because she was a regular Mass goer. And the thing he remembered, aside from the extraordinary aesthetics and beauty of the Mass, she grilled him, but since he was only six, she grilled him with one question over and over again. And at the age of six, Eliot said, his nanny, Annie Dunn, taught him that God was the first cause. There was a first cause, and the first cause was God. I have a funny feeling that his philosophical bent from that point on was formed by pondering this one question that had to be so different in every way from what he was used to and what he was getting in the religious training around him. One other thing that was happening, and this was even before he started reading the literature. This is reported by one of his older sisters, and I think this is just absolutely fascinating. His older sister remembered when Eliot was learning to talk. That wonderful point where children are just making inarticulate noises and babbling and trying to imitate what they're hearing the adults around them saying. And what she said was, he was obsessed with sounding the rhythm of sentences without ever trying to shape words. Now, most children begin with mama, dada, doggy, and through that way come to assemble a vocabulary and come to learn what language is. Eliot began with full sentences minus words, but he was aware of the rhythm of the sentences that were being spoken. And he had so that the words didn't matter, but the rhythms were somehow permeating his being. It's simply amazing. And he admits something. This is many years later when he's an acclaimed poet. He's talking about the music of poetry that I'll talk about at greater length later, but he says, the properties in music which most concern the poet are the sense of rhythm and the sense of structure. I think it might be possible for a poet to work too closely to musical analogies, but I know that a poem or a passage of a poem may tend to realize itself first as a particular rhythm before it reaches expression in words, and that this rhythm may bring to birth the idea and the image, and I do not believe that this is an experience peculiar to myself. A rhythm would get into his head, and then he would try to find the words and the ideas that would match the rhythm. Sounds very peculiar for those of us who aren't into poetry or writing poetry. But yet, once you come to know Eliot, the rhythms, the music of the verse are positively overwhelming. And the very definition of poetry is that poetry is the union of sound and sense, in which the sounds of the words are as important as what the words say. So that, as our great American poet Robert Frost used to say, when asked what is poetry, Frost would say, poetry is that which gets lost in translation. Meaning, if I translate a poem from English into German, I might get what the words mean, but I've lost the poetry because the music of the words has changed. I don't hear the sounds of the words. And with Mr. Eliot, April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire. How do you translate something like that? It's nearly impossible. The rhythms were, I mean, he was obsessed. He had, maybe it's because of the large ears, I don't know. But he had this amazing, amazing sense of rhythm before he could even speak. those of us who believe God creates every individual soul for a set purpose and gives each individual soul specific gifts and talents are not surprised by this. If you see a little boy playing with building blocks and then tinker toys and then at what we used to call erector sets, you know, he's probably not going to grow up to be a ballet dancer. It's just not going to happen. The expression, in the same way that little girls who are given dolls and love their dolly and take care of their dolly, they're meant to be mothers in spite of what the world tries to do to stop them. And even within the home, I believe women are given special characteristics, special qualities that are designed to help them raise the children that God then gives them. There's a wonderful moment in Dante, it's in the Purgatorio, where Dante says that one of the greatest problems in the world is parents forcing their children into career paths that the children were not suited for when they were created by God. And there's, you know, in a way, what the parents must sensibly do is try to discover what those attributes are in the child that come out at an early age and encourage those, rather than push or shove in a different direction, which can be very damaging and unfulfilling. In that sense, Eliot was blessed with his mother who loved poetry and wrote poetry. So that poetry was a part of his home the whole time that he was growing up. One other element, very important element. Well, let me put it this way. The house was on Locust Street in downtown St. Louis. The neighborhood had once been very fancy. It was starting to deteriorate a bit. It was still a good neighborhood. But as with all of the American cities, a decline came, things began to change. It was very close to the Mississippi River, so that Eliot, as a child, spent much time on the banks of the Mississippi, the river flowing right through St. Louis, and we'll see in the later poems it haunted him. It became something that was so much a part of his understanding, his vision of life, it was always there with him. Also close by the house was a little music hall, light opera, comic opera company, that he would sneak into when he could, that he was aware of. And he had a love from his youngest days of popular entertainment. When he was growing up, that little theater near him originated a song that became an American, it swept America, became an America classic. Everybody was singing it. It's called "There'll Be a Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight." Some of you may remember it. He learned it and he sang it for the rest of his days. It was so ingrained in him that it became an obsession with him almost. Those songs he learned when he was young, a ballad that also came out of the city of St. Louis, the Ballad of Frankie and Johnny, based on a terrible murder that took place in St. Louis, a love that went bad. And it ended up in bloodshed. So, of course, it was turned into a popular song. And that was something that he was aware of and learned. Just a few blocks, maybe less than a mile from where he lived, there was a young black composer named Scott Joplin who wrote Ragtime. And the Ragtime hit The Entertainer was written just a few blocks away from where Eliot grew up. This popular entertainment was all around him. And it became as much an important part of his understanding as did the great classic works that he was reading and absorbing at the same time. So, 1896, one of the most devastating tornadoes to ever hit America hit St. Louis. It destroyed the city. So at the time, he would have been an 8-year-old boy, actually 7. He wouldn't have been 8 yet. And went through this terrific storm and then wandered through a city that was decimated, absolutely destroyed. Again, A memory like that in a young child is something that will hold forever. And I'm convinced there are moments, again, in the wasteland when the storm is rising and the thunder is on the horizon that had to have come out of that experience of the fear of the storm coming and then the desolation caused by the storm after it has wrought its fury on a city. Now, during the summers, the family went away. They still had the Massachusetts connection. His father built a house in Gloucester, Massachusetts, right on the water, and every summer it became their summer home, and the young Elliot loved going to the seashore and became a very good sailor. He spent time with sailors in the area, learned to sail, and if you read his poetry, there are references and images of sailing that pop up repeatedly, constantly. And he became fascinated with the bird life of the area and was very aware of the birds that he heard in that area of Massachusetts that he didn't hear back in St. Louis, in the city. It was part of his connection with nature, and over again, these are just a few lines from The Wasteland, where the hermit thrush sings in the pine trees, drip, drop, drip, drop, 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 drop. It's wonderful. The sound of the thrush in the pines and the water dripping off the trees. Those memories stayed with him, and he could turn those memories into poetry as well. One other thing that came from those early years. He remembered the personalities and the people who were in the neighborhood around him and immortalized them by using their names. There was a furniture company that made parlor furniture for the little sitting room parlors of these old houses at the end of the 19th century. And the furniture maker's name was Prufrock, the Prufrock Manufacturing Company. And, of course, immortalized in the title of a poem that revolutionized English poetry, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. Now, of course, J. Alfred wasn't the man's first name, but Prufrock stayed with him. There was a very serious lady who gave lectures to the women's clubs, who was the niece of Harriet Beecher Stowe, the abolitionist who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, that was a friend of his mother's, and her name was Mrs. Stetson, and her name shows up in the first part of The Wasteland, but in male form, Stetson, but he remembers her there. There was a Dr. Sweeney, and Sweeney peddled phony, lousy ointments and medicine. His biggest success was a remedy for male ailments. I'll say no more about it. But again, he was a complete phony, as were most of those snake oil salesmen back then, confidence men. The Wimberleys were just telling me they watched W.C. Fields as Mr. Micawber in the Copperfield film. There's a wonderful W.C. Fields movie called The Old-Fashioned Way, where he's leading a theatrical troupe and they're run from town to town and he finally has to give it up. And so he becomes a snake oil salesman. The movie ends with Fields selling. He's got a whole crowd gathered around him. People would come and listen to these people. And he's saying, "For many years I have suffered from hoarseness. Hoarseness has plagued me my whole life. And I have finally found a medication that will take care of the problem." He opens it up, takes a big swig. "It cures hoarseness!" And the movie ends with people putting up money. Well, it was everywhere in America at the time. Well, Dr. Sweeney was one of them. And there are at least four fragmented poems or short poems about a character named Sweeney that Eliot created, who is an absolute lower-class lout and semi-barbarian. So Dr. Sweeney gets immortalized. And then the second school that he went to an academy as a young boy called Smith Academy, and then went to one called Milton Academy. He had a fellow pupil at Milton that was named Ronald McCavity. And the name stuck with him. And McCavity, okay? There's no one like McCavity. He's broken every human law. He breaks the law of gravity. It's one of the great cat poems. And McCavity is immortalized now. So he remembered these people. I think partially, again, notice the names. And some of the Prufrock, Sweeney, McCavity. The sounds of the names are wonderful. So he was responding to that as well. Now, his very first poem was written while he was at Smith Academy. His first poem is lost. It's a shame. He wrote it as a very young boy, and the poem was about not wanting to go to school on Monday morning. It would be a children's classic, I'm sure. But here's the first one that we have. And as with everything with Eliot, it comes from a source that he adapts. Here's the original. It's from a Lewis Carroll book called Sylvie and Bruno. And this is a little poem. He thought he saw an elephant that practiced on a fife. He looked again and found it was a letter from his wife. At length I realized, he said, the bitterness of life. Well, Eliot was fascinated by that. Just ran. So he does his own little version and signed the poem Eliot S. Thomas. Thomas Stearns Eliot. He turns his name around. I thought I saw an elephant a-riding on a bus. I looked again and found, alas, 'twas only us. So, again, you get the little boy imitating, and using these models that he adopts. He himself admitted he was not a good student. The education he had, the various studies he did, quite remarkable. He got Latin, he got Greek, he learned French. He read the classics. It seems unimaginable. But he didn't want to go to school. And as he grew older, his interest in school waned more and more. Until by the time he went from Smith Academy to Milton Academy and then to Harvard. By the time he got to Harvard, he barely got through. There were times when the president of Harvard wrote his father and said, well, we don't know if he's going to make it because he's not doing well in this subject and he's failing this subject. And Eliot would buck up and get through simply to please his father. His father was putting out the money, and therefore he felt he owed it to his father. So he made it through. But he himself says he wasn't a good student. But years later, he had this criticism of his own education. He told his mother that he was very sorry that he had been through Harvard's elective system because it encouraged him simply to drift from course to course. I was one of the victims of the elective system. I have always regretted that as an undergraduate, I did not stick to Latin and Greek and some mathematics and leave alone all the things I dabbled in year after year. And now, of course, that elective system has totally taken over every university. And most of the courses that are offered are meaningless. So it's now simply drifting from empty course to stupid course to insane course. What he understood was what the student needs is a program of study where you learn certain things in depth. And for him, there's also the understanding learning those classic languages were essential. Learning mathematics, essential. It's a very real insight and a remarkable one. Oh my, I'm look at me. I talk too much. All right, I have to speed up. Now, the other thing that happened at Harvard, and this is very understandable, given his Unitarian, Puritanistic background, he began writing obscene verse. I can't read any of it. He didn't want any of it published. Some of his friends saved bits of it, and it did come out in a book called Eccentricities of the March Hare that was published only about 20 years ago. He would have been furious because he didn't want it to see the light of day. Rich in imagination, very clear, brilliant use of language and imagery and rhythms, but unbelievably bawdy. with the kind of freedom in the subject that would have been shocking back then. Absolutely shocking. The whole series of them called the King Bolo poems, about a king in Africa and his many wives. I'll say no more. He did, however, have one triumph in his Harvard years. I find this just astonishing. He was the first person in America to use the full word that we now simply call BS in print. He wrote a poem, the title of which is The Triumph of BS. And again, it's an attack on Harvard and what was going on there. But first instance in print of that word, which becomes increasingly important as the world gets crazier. By the way, here's something very important. If you learn nothing else tonight, this will be good. It is now so pervasive that even the deaf have a sign for it, okay? Which is one of my favorite signs in the world, because you can use it and nobody knows what you're doing. And it's simply this. You put the right arm over the left arm, and then you make the horns, and then you let a deposit loose, okay? So if you're speaking to someone and you really can't stand what's being said, and you know you're wasting your time, you don't want to hear anymore, but you can't insult the person directly by saying, that's a load of, you simply do what the deaf do. Now you can't say you didn't learn anything important here tonight. He graduated from Harvard. He did get some things along the way, but his real interests were things he discovered on his own. And one of the sorrows about what's happening in modern libraries, not just university libraries, but everywhere, because I remember this myself. I would go to the university library to research a paper on a subject I didn't want to write. I had no interest in. But I'd wander into the stacks, and as I'm walking along, I'd suddenly see a book that caught my eye, and I'd pull it off the shelf, and I'd end up spending my time reading about something I wasn't supposed to for doing my serious scholastic work, but get absorbed in it and actually learn something. Well, Eliot did this all the time. And Harvard had just received a new 3-volume set on French symbolist poetry that fascinated him. And he went through all the books, and when he graduated from Harvard, went to Paris for a while because he wanted to immerse himself in the poetry of these French symbolist writers. Baudelaire, Laforgue was the big one that he was most taken by. Now, here's a curiosity. You have a young American who becomes interested in French poetry and goes to France to study French poetry written by poets whose principal influence was Edgar Allan Poe, an American poet. You get this strange circular thing that happened. Now, Eliot had loved Poe as a young man when he first read him. He was fascinated, especially by Poe's poetry, as were the French. So there was a sympathy there between them right from the beginning, and he learned much from Laforgue. But mainly what he learned had to do with the subjects that a poet could write about and the freedom to break loose of the old poetic conventions. Eliot said at one point that if he hadn't discovered the French poets, he couldn't have become a poet, because poetry in the English language had hit a dead end. There was no sense of where you go next with it. It was written out, the old forms were dead, and for years, decades, poets had simply been trying to pour new poetry into very old forms. And what you got was this uninteresting old mixture of things that had been done better long before. The French broke him out of all that, And it's why he became the first and most influential of the modern poets, because he broke entirely new ground. And one of the ways in which he did it, what he learned from Lefort, was that you could write about subjects that had not been written about before, including the reality of life that was out there that human beings were living in that no longer connected with what poets were expected to write about. Let me give an example. The Romantic poets, that whole school, and Eliot was not fond of them. He thought it was a dead end, and there were other reasons he didn't care for them. I'll get into in a moment. But for Wordsworth to spend time in the Lake District, we're not surprised that he can write, "I wandered lonely as a cloud," and talk about coming upon the daffodils. That was the world he knew. Eliot grew up in urban St. Louis. And the French poets had grown up in a Paris that was beginning to go into decline and had neighborhoods that were not all lovely. In fact, Eliot said at one point, he had a sense of the decay around him in Locust Street. What had once been a very lovely neighborhood was in decline. A neighborhood which had become shabby to a degree approaching slumminess after our friends and acquaintances had moved further west. In my childhood, before the days of motor cars, people lived in town, who lived in town stayed in town. So it was that for 9 months of the year, my scenery was exclusively urban and a good deal of it seedy, drabbly urban at that. This is what he knew. This is what was around him. And it wouldn't have occurred to him, you can write poetry about that. The French taught him, why can't you? That is the real world around you. And what Eliot is doing from the start is looking clearly at the world that at that time he was living in, that presented itself to his eye, and he would write about it. Which is why, in many of the earliest poems, he will write about things that simply were shocking when the earliest poems came out, and were severely criticized, and he was simply dismissed as it's not anything that you could write about. One of his preludes, he has a series of four little brief preludes that appeared in the first volume of his that was printed in 1917. Here's the prelude number one, very short. The winter evening settles down with smell of steaks in passageways. 6 o'clock, the burnt-out ends of smoky days. And now a gusty shower wraps the grimy scraps of withered leaves about your feet, and newspapers from vacant lots. The showers beat on broken blinds and chimney pots, and at the corner of the street, a lonely cab horse steams and stamps, and then the lighting of the lamps. It's not a pretty picture. It's not pretty at all. But it was real. And from the beginning, his poet's mind reached out, saw what was there, and set it down with fresh language, fresh rhythms, and images that were stark and startling. Many of the French poets were called imagists, and their notion was, you don't necessarily write at length describing something, you find one image that will just brand it in the hearer's mind, okay? It will simply just stick there. And will be there. Once it's heard, it's hard to forget. And this takes us to J. Alfred Prufrock, the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock. He worked on it for a number of years. He actually finished it in 1911. Wasn't published until 1917. He finished it. He'd begun working on it. He had left Paris, was traveling around Europe. He finished it in Munich, and this was at the end of a year when he himself had come down with scarlet fever, cerebral anemia. He could have died from either of them in that year. He was lost, wasn't sure where he was going. What he knew was he wanted to write poetry. He survived, but he writes this first major poem, the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, and in the title, you know, something has entered the world of poetry that had not been there before. If it was the love song of Count and Countess so-and-so, we'd be ready to sit back and just have beauty and loveliness wash over us. This is the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock. The title set people's teeth on edge. And then he draws one in with an opening that sounds like we're going to get lovely romantic poetry. Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Punch to the jaw. Most readers wouldn't get past line 3. This is a madman. This and toss it. He took the poem when he was introduced to another American poet living abroad named Ezra Pound. Ezra Pound read the poem and contacted everybody he knew and said, support this young man. Here is talent. And suddenly Pound opened up. Benefactors, people who helped him, who supported him. Again, all along, Pound was there, supporting Eliot, arguing with Eliot. He found a fellow poet, along with the French poets. And suddenly, he was being absorbed into the world of poetry. Now, let me continue to make that earlier point about what he's writing about. Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights in one-night cheap hotels and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells. Streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit. Notice the irregular rhymes, internal rhymes. This hadn't been done before. Long line, short line. There's rhythm there, but you can't quite follow what it is. There's not a regular rhythmic pattern that you can follow. And where is this going? Now, the astonishing thing, again, the image itself of the patient etherized upon the table. In Boston, near Harvard, while Eliot was there, they put up a monument and a memorial to the doctor who invented ether. And it must have seemed so strange to Eliot in terms of this is a new world, where suddenly we are honoring this man who produced, a scientist who produced a gas that will knock you out. And this haunted him the rest of his life. We come to the late poems. The Four Quartets, this is the second of the Four Quartets, East Coker. Let me just read you this little passage. You'll see it's still there. Very different poetry, very different rhythm and sound. It's a fairly long passage. This comes at the end. I'm going to read the whole thing because I want to. I said to my soul, be still and let the dark come upon you, which shall be the darkness of God. As in a theater, the lights are extinguished for the scene to be changed with a hollow rumble of wings, with a movement of darkness on darkness, and we know that the hills and the trees, the distant panorama, and the bold imposing facade are all being rolled away. Or as when an underground train in the tube stops too long between stations, and the conversation rises and slowly fades into silence, and you see behind every face the mental emptiness deepen, leaving only the growing terror of nothing to think about. Or when, under ether, the mind is conscious, but conscious of nothing, I said to my soul, be still. Boom! Image pops up again. It pops up again. And then, even later, in one of the very great plays called The Cocktail Party that you're going to hear a lot about. First act, first scene, a failed cocktail party. I'll talk about it later, but the host is there, and there's a guest who has shown up, and the host has no idea who this man is. All he does is drink a lot of gin and get very tipsy. And the host is starting to ask questions, why are you here? How did you end up? The wife isn't there. Did my wife invite you? And the host says, nobody likes to be left with a mystery. He says, yes, it's unfinished, and nobody likes to be left with a mystery, but there's more to it than that. There's a loss of personality. Or rather, you've lost touch with the person you thought you were. You no longer feel quite human. You're suddenly reduced to the status of an object, a living object, but no longer a person. It's always happening because one is an object as well as a person, but we forget about it as quickly as we can. When you've dressed for a party and are going downstairs with everything about you arranged to support you in the role you have chosen, then sometimes when you come to the bottom step, there is one step more than your feet expected and you come down with a jolt. Just for a moment, you have the experience of being an object at the mercy of a malevolent staircase. Or take a surgical operation. In consultation with the doctor and the surgeon, in going to bed in the nursing home, in talking to the matron, you are still the subject, the center of reality. But stretched on the table, you are a piece of furniture in a repair shop. For those who surround you, the masked actors, all there is of you is your body, and the you is withdrawn. May I replenish? the images that stayed with him, that he kept reinventing, that he would re-explore. And that brings us, that little passage brings us to another obsession. Back to what I said was going to be the key of the talk right now. Who was he? This poem that he writes when he is 23 years old, J. Alfred Prufrock is the voice of a middle-aged man. The poem is one possessed of the staleness of life, the monotony of life, the boredom of life, the complete crippling of the will, the sense of a world gone flat, walking through a world that is pointless, where you can't even ask major questions because you don't know what they are, and if you ask them, no one would be interested, no one concerned, where there's a hint of going to shabby places that you're ashamed of, where you are so self-conscious that you can barely stand to be around other people. And I have known the eyes already, known them all, the eyes that fix you in a formulated phrase, and when I am formulated, sprawling on a pin, when I am pinned and wriggling on the wall, then how should I begin to spit out all the butt ends of my days and ways, and how should I presume, for I have known them all, already known them all, have known the evenings, mornings, afternoons. I have measured out my life with coffee spoons. There's excitement for you. There's romance. It's a new world. It's a new world. No, I am not Prince Hamlet, nor was meant to be. Am an attendant lord, one that will do to swell a progress, start a scene or two, advise the prince, no doubt an easy tool, deferential, glad to be of use, politic, cautious and meticulous, full of high sentence but a bit obtuse, at times indeed, almost ridiculous, almost at times the fool. I grow old, I grow old. I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled. At the age of 22, 23, Eliot was middle-aged. Midlife crisis. And what kept him going was the poetry. Was the poetry, which was new and exciting. Now, the end of Prufrock, one other thing that he learned from Laforgue, and credited for it, you can take these shabby surroundings and at the same time combine them in the same poem with fantasy. We can go from the dirty streets and alleys to suddenly a strange, miraculous world almost without transition, because the time for logical transitions is gone, and now we don't know where we are, but the mind can go almost anywhere. Shall I part my hair behind? Do I dare to eat a peach? I shall wear white flannel trousers and walk upon the beach. I have heard the mermaids singing each to each. I do not think that they will sing to me. I have seen them riding seaward on the waves, combing the white hair of the waves blown back when the wind blows the water white and black. We have lingered in the chambers of the sea by sea girls wreathed with seaweed red and brown till human voices wake us and we drown. End of poem. It's haunting. It's haunting. What does it mean? And what we get there is something that Eliot insisted on, which was, you cannot, on the first exposure to a poem, understand it the way you would understand a prose passage. Poetry being music, Eliot said, reaches the heart before it reaches the mind. You are somehow moved to feel something without knowing why you're feeling it or understanding it exactly. And if you try to explain it immediately or look at details and what does this mean, you're going to lose what the poem is. The destruction of poetry in high schools and colleges came about by lousy teachers who told their students, you have to find the hidden meaning in the poem. Nonsense. What you have to do is learn the poem by heart, recite it over and over, a poem you like and respond to, until it's in your blood and in your heart, and then suddenly when you're reciting it one day, you say, oh, now wait, I understand this links with that. And even that is not prose explanation of something. It's the sense of the unity and power of the structure of the verse. And that's what Eliot insisted on. So that it is as foolish in one sense as to... Imagine sitting down and saying, now explain to me what the first movement of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata means. Well, I can tell you what I feel like when I hear it. I can tell you about the mood it creates. I know the emotion it evokes in me. What do you mean by it? Well, explicate it. What exactly is he saying here? And tell me in three logical steps. I can't do it. Now, words are different because words do have meaning. But at the same time, it's the music we hear first. It's the music that draws one in. Another reason. Read it aloud, read it aloud, read it many times aloud in order to begin to get at what's going on there. It's a middle-aged man's poem written by a 22, 23-year-old. In his second volume of poems, which was issued in 1920, again with Ezra Pound was there all the way helping along, the first poem, and poets always, if they put a volume out, put what they think is their best work at the beginning. This is a classic poem. It's a great poem called Gerontium, which is a name he invents, which obviously, gerontology means old age. And the first lines, here I am, an old man in a dry mouth, being read to by a boy, waiting for rain. And he goes from proof rock, where he's middle-aged, to just a few years later writing a poem in which he's taking on the persona of an old man. And the sense of everything around going dry and waiting for rain, which will become central to the wasteland. Absolutely central to the wasteland. But please notice, what he's done from the beginning, and it's with most of the, even the early poems, is he is evacuating his own personality from the poem and assuming a mask. And he knew, in a way, He knew he was going to do it. I'm at the beginning of Proof Rock again. There will be time to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. There will be time to murder and create, and time for all the works and days of hands that lift and drop a question on your plate. But what you are doing is preparing a face to meet the faces that you meet. Now, he would write at length about the need for the poet to get rid of his own personality as he writes. This seems very strange, but it was almost an obsession with him. I've got to jump ahead here, sorry. Here we are. Great writers put themselves and their personal imaginings out of sight. Their writing becomes a kind of transparent window on which reality is reflected, and through which people see not them, but that of which they write. How much we know of Shakespeare's characters, how little we know of Shakespeare. It's a wonderful phrase. A kind of transparent window on which reality is reflected, and the personality of the poet should be out of the way. Again, one reason he objected to the Romantics. You read Keats, you're reading about Keats. You read Wordsworth, the prelude is all about Wordsworth. And his objection was they overwhelmed their own poems. Now, they were youthful, they had the energy of youth. Youth, the young tend to be self-obsessed. Maybe you didn't know this. But the young tend to be self-obsessed. And he thought it showed in the poetry. And of course, they all died young. But Wordsworth didn't. But he ran dry. His poetic vein ran dry when he was still young. And Eliot believed one reason was there was nothing more for them to do. So he was very conscious. But the other question is this. Was part of it his shyness and needing to create a face that he could present to the world? Because he himself felt so uncomfortable in it. That may well have been it. But at the same time, what came out of it was the belief that a poet should not intrude into the poem. We read these poems, and we're not thinking about Mr. Eliot. We're thinking about that world out there, that modern world out there, that he is reflecting for us, telling us something about the nature of the modern world, and he will tell us everything about it if he is transparent, if there is something, if he is holding the mirror up to nature, as Hamlet says, then he's going to show it all. He's going to show it all. And he does. But in the process, he will assume characters. Now, I won't get as far with this as I hope to, because I talk too much. But I can do a little bit of it here, which is the following. This being the case, when he comes to write this first huge, quite literally, art-changing poem called The Wasteland, he does two things that he'd already done in the earlier poems. Everything is open for presentation. He will not leave anything out, okay? He has no need to write pretty poetry. He's going to write real poetry about a real world in which he finds himself. Number two, he's not in The Wasteland just taking one voice, one persona. There are dozens of voices that float through that poem. We hear one voice, we hear a different voice, we meet one character, suddenly that character transforms into a different character. And it's part of the uneasiness as we go through the poem. We don't know for certain who's talking to us, or when that person becomes a different person, when one voice suddenly changes into another voice, when it's Eliot who's speaking, or Dante who's speaking, or Thomas Kidd who's speaking, or Shakespeare who's speaking, or if we have a reference that's biblical from Ezekiel. Who's talking here? And the point is, it is almost impossible to make any sense of that world that's out there, because we don't know what is going on out there. How do we get a handle on it? How can I understand this? How can I know what's happening in this world in which I'm living? And he's saying you can't, because it's a dead world, haunted by ghosts. Ghosts from Greek mythology, ghosts from Elizabethan drama, ghosts from modern French symbolist poetry, ghosts from people that he knew, that he and voices he reproduces, characters that he creates who suddenly will be given a section of the poem to discuss, and they're constantly shifting and changing and merging. We have nowhere to stand other than the rhythms that are altering, the occasional rhymes. We have to cling to the sound of the poetry, because it's the only sense we have. It's the only thing that we can hold onto in a world that can no longer be defined. The original title of The Wasteland was taken from a Dickens novel, Our Mutual Friend, where a character named Sloppy is being praised by a lady. Sloppy is not real bright, and certainly not attractive, and very young, but very kind-hearted, with a very unfortunate name. I'd like you to meet my friend Sloppy. So pleased to meet you, Mr. Sloppy. What a treat. But the woman is praising him because she can't read, and Sloppy can, and he brings the evening newspaper, and he reads the newspaper to her. It's the only way she can get the news. And in praising him, she says, "And he do the police in different voices." When he comes to a policeman in the news report, he changes his voice. That was the original title of The Wasteland. He do the police in different voices. Meaning that Eliot knew very well what this poem was and where it was going, but then decided that was the method, not the ultimate vision. The ultimate vision was barrenness, dryness, and therefore the poem became The Wasteland. And the original epigraph, which he then canceled, was originally from Conrad's Heart of Darkness, the dying words of Mr. Kurtz, the horror. The Heart of Darkness will show up soon. We'll look at that later. Let me do one last thing, because I am running out of time here. Hard to believe. Here is the replacement epigraph. The epigraph is just a little quotation at the beginning of a work that an author will append there to give you some clue as to what's in the work, okay? Eliot did it constantly. By the way, this little book is called A Guide to the Selected Poems of T.S. Eliot. It only goes up through Ash Wednesday, but what this man did was unearth all the references he could find and tell you where they come from, because Eliot put everything and everybody in. You would go mad trying to sort out what he took from where and where it all comes from. But this gentleman did it for you. His name is Mr. Southam, S-O-U-T-H-A-M. But here is the replacement epigraph that appears at the beginning of The Wasteland. It comes from a work by the Roman writer Petronius called the Satyricon, in which the Sibyl from Greek mythology, a woman with prophetic powers, she asked for eternal youth, but she forgot to ask. She asked for eternal life on earth, but didn't ask for eternal youth. So she's aging. She's living forever, but she just gets older and older. And the epigraph says, "For once I saw with my very own eyes the Sibyl at Cumae hanging in a cage. And when the boys said to her, 'Sibyl, what do you want?' she answered, 'I want to die.'" Tomorrow morning I'll get into The Wasteland in depth, so I hope it's a bright, sunny morning. And you're all in a good mood. And I will remind you once again, in my end is my beginning, how unpleasant to meet Mr. Elliott.